Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. Today is the 25th of September, 2020. So glad to have you tuned in this afternoon and glad to welcome to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Sally Donato. And we're going to be talking today about fact or fiction, busting the myths of equine health. We're going to be talking about things about horses that people might misunderstand. And horse owners, I kind of feel, Dr. Donato, are pretty well informed overall. That is to say, when I've ever spoken to somebody who is kind of active in horse ownership or care or so forth, they seem to know a lot about the animals that they take care of. And that's pretty understandable. People and horses have really remarkable relationships. But it's possible, I imagine, for people in the broader public even, maybe even people who care for horses, to kind of be a little bit off about some of the aspects of the care of horses, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me today. I say horse owners are very good at researching all the various aspects of horse health, but as you know, there's a lot of information out there on the internet, and some of it is better than others.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the internet, because internet is certainly a double-edged sword, right? It can bring so many important pieces of information into our lives that we might have had a harder time accessing before, but it can also give us so much that is so wrong. So let's maybe,
say Dr. Google can be a friend or a foe.
Well, the good news is that on the internet, there are, of course, reputable websites that you can probably generally rely on the information they provide, right? Like if you were linking to a university website or some large veterinary organization's website, you can probably be reasonably assured that the information has been vetted somehow.
Absolutely. For horse owners, I often recommend the AAEP, which is the American Association of Equine Practitioners. They have a wealth of resources geared particularly toward horse owners and horse health care.
Yeah, okay. And that's really good information. And of course, the questions that I'm going to ask you today are coming from me, a total layperson with really very limited experience with horses. I have been on a horse one time in my life. It was a positive experience, for sure. But it is something that I don't know a lot about, horses, that is. And I will have questions for you that will kind of sound like naive questions, but I hope that the people listening to the show who don't have horses will maybe find something interesting and informative about it. So let's kind of start with some of the big questions, right? Horses, we all know they're like mammals. They have relationships with humans in which they like do work, or they are for recreation, right? And they have health needs, though, just like our dogs and cats that we keep as pets, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they sure do. They need regular medical maintenance care, just like you said, like you or any of our other house pets would.
This kind of maintenance care includes what?
So regular vaccinations are important for protecting against infectious disease, some of which come from the environment and some of which come from other horses, similar to the common cold or other viruses that may be important. And then horses are also susceptible to intestinal parasites, particularly in areas like the Southeast, where we have a very warm climate. It doesn't freeze very much in the winter here, and so we don't have a die-off of those the parasites that may be overwintering in the ground. And so we have particularly high pressures for things called helminths, so they're intestinal worms that can parasitize a horse and cause them to lose weight or have what we call ill thrift, which means like a poor hair coat, perhaps not a very good body condition given the nutrition the owner might be giving, and a variety of other sort of deleterious health effects. And so horses need to be monitored for intestinal parasitism and treated accordingly. Then other routine maintenance might be regular dental work. Some horses need to actually go to the dentist. Sometimes the dentist needs to come to the barn and have dental work. Their teeth are somewhat different than human teeth. And then sometimes their feet need to be worked on. So they have hooves that grow continuously, similar to a fingernail. And depending on what you do with your horse, they may need to have their hooves trimmed or even have shoes applied.
Okay, great. So you just brought up sort of three important things. I kind of want to tackle them one by one. And in the first, I think that you mentioned, had to do with appropriate vaccines. Vaccinations are important for our pets for a variety of different reasons to prevent disease and so forth. What are some of the vaccines that are available and usually recommended for horses, especially in the South where we live?
Sure. So probably the most important ones are what we call the core vaccines. And there's five of those vaccines or five of those core diseases. And this actually brings up a really good equine myth that's very relevant to this year with everyone, with humans being very limited in their travel. They're staying home more often than they were in previous years. Not surprisingly, their animals are not traveling this year either. And so lots of horses that previously may have traveled for showing or for riding and gone on and off a farm or had contact with outside animal herds have now been standing around at their barn or their home property throughout this whole year. And so a misconception or a myth relevant this year is, do those horses need to be vaccinated or that they don't need to be vaccinated because they might have had contact with no other horses at all or no other new horses. So they might be standing around with the same horses that they've always been used to. And the misconception or the myth is that they won't have any challenge or exposure to any infectious diseases for which we might vaccinate. And the core vaccines have been designated as cores because they are diseases that cause significant health negative effects in horses that get infected. And they cannot be prevented by any reasonable strategy, including isolation, other than vaccination. And so those vaccines are still recommended for every horse in every scenario, every part of the country, whether it's one horse in your backyard that never sees another horse or a horse that's traveling even all over the world potentially for horse shows. And those core diseases are tetanus, which lives in the dirt. So I often tell owners, you have to think about where these diseases are coming from and then decide, can you reasonably prevent this without vaccination? So unless your horse doesn't contact dirt, which I often joke, I've seen a few show horses that might actually qualify for this. But unless he doesn't touch any dirt, then he is at risk for tetanus because it's a bacteria that lives in the soil and gains contact to the animal via a wound, so similar to other animals and including people, which is why if you step on a nail or get a bad cut or laceration, you may get a tetanus booster when you go into the emergency room. And then there's a few viruses that we worry about, Eastern and Western equine encephalomyelitis, which is a little bit of a mouthful, so we shorten it to EEE or triple E and WEE. These are arboviruses, which means they are infectious viral pathogens that are carried by mosquitoes. And as everybody knows, Florida, probably the mosquito capital of the country, I would say. So unless your horse doesn't have contact with mosquitoes, they could contract these diseases. And these are neurologic diseases that are very serious and almost always fatal. So not something that you want your horse to contract at all by any means. West Nile virus is similar. That's another arbovirus. Now, this one humans can get, not from horses, but from infected mosquitoes. And we do certainly see more cases of triple E, the Eastern encephalomyelitis, and West Nile here in Florida than anywhere else in the country. So we really are an epicenter. And then the last one is rabies. And so rabies is a virus that is carried in infected wildlife, so skunks and raccoons and sometimes bats. And unless your horse is in an environment that has no access whatsoever to wildlife, which is not probably many horses at all, then rabies is a risk. Luckily, rabies is very, very rare, more rare than the diseases I just mentioned, but it's probably the most concerning of all of the core diseases because It's the only one that is what we consider to be zoonotic, meaning that an infected horse can infect a human with rabies. And rabies, once clinical signs have developed, is 100% uniformly fatal. So that's a disease of very high concern with horse owners and veterinarians and human health professionals. And so we really advocate that even though it's very rare, to keep all horses up to date on their vaccines for all of those diseases, actually. And it's fairly easy to do after an initial series where a horse gets 2 to 3 vaccines in quick succession. So similar to, say, your childhood vaccines for humans or immunizations, then it's usually just an annual booster for most cores. Now, the triple E and West Nile virus, particularly because we have such high pressure with and such high burdens in our mosquito populations here in Florida, and our mosquito season never really ends, we recommend that horses be vaccinated at least twice a year for those two diseases, West Nile and triple E.
Okay. There's a lot of really great information there, Dr. Donata. I want to ask you, the vaccinations that you mentioned, one in specifically against rabies. Now, my understanding is that in many municipalities across the country and here in Florida as well, a rabies vaccine is required for many household pets. Is that true for horses? Is there a legal requirement that horse owners vaccinate their horses against rabies?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, it is, to my knowledge, it is not a law here, or I haven't lived in any states where it was a law. However, if your horse develops neurologic signs, clinical signs of neurologic disease, and it comes to a hospital such as UF, its vaccine history for rabies is one of the first and most important questions that we will ask. And it's really important for horse owners to know that if your horse has an inadequate vaccine history for rabies, then that disease moves up in our differential list in a horse that has neurologic signs. And the human risk is so great that we may only be able to provide limited human contact or even medical care to that animal while it's here in the hospital, because there is a risk of humans contracting the disease if the horse does indeed have rabies. It doesn't mean that we wouldn't be able to see the horse or treat the horse in the hospital. We do treat what we consider to be rabies suspects, which would be horses that have neurologic disease that have not been vaccinated recently enough to be considered current, but it can really limit our ability to handle them safely.
Right.
And unfortunately, the only way to diagnose rabies definitively is with an autopsy. We don't have a blood test or a test for rabies while the animal is alive. And so that also becomes a really, it just makes it really difficult to handle horses that could have rabies here in the hospital safely.
Well, how would a horse's caretaker know or come to suspect that the horse had perhaps contracted rabies?
Drastic changes in behavior are a common clinical sign of rabies in cattle and horses. So horses that are normally, say, tractable or calm can become maniacal or aggressive. Rabies is a little bit of a frightening disease because it presents uniquely in every case. Luckily, we don't see it very often, but some horses will start off with a lameness for no reason, so no sign of an injury, but will have one limb that they're favoring more than the others, and then that may progress to full-on fulminant signs of brain disorder, which might be a horse that is comatose. They can have seizures. The classic sort of what you think about the excessive saliva or drool production is not seen uniformly in all affected animals, but it certainly can be. And most veterinarians are pretty acutely aware of those signs, because a horse that might be producing excessive saliva, that also is how a horse that has choked may present, in which case you would need to work inside their mouth and in their esophagus to relieve their choke. But if the horse has not been vaccinated well for rabies, then most veterinarians would be pretty tentative or pretty hesitant to handle that horse's mouth.
I understand. Before we take our first break, and just to sort of wrap up the topic of rabies, lest we alarm too many people, is rabies a condition that many horses are afflicted with? Do you see many cases every year?
No, thank goodness. It's very, very, as I mentioned, it's very, very rare. And really the best thing to do is just to make sure that your horse gets one vaccine a year for rabies. It's a very effective vaccine, and that way your horse is protected just the same as your cats and dogs, and can get all the care that it might need should it develop neurologic disease from some other cause.
And finally, before we take our first break on the topic of vaccines, is it possible that any of the vaccinations that horses are administered as part of their kind of general wellness, might they cause any kind of health problems in the wake of the vaccination itself?
Yeah, that's a great question. Luckily, our vaccines that we use in horses are considered very safe. Side effects or complications are very rare. The most common thing we may see is some horses might develop some soreness where the vaccine was given, which is usually in the neck or in the muscles of the hip and rump. So similar to when you get a vaccine in your arm, you might feel like somebody punched you in the arm for a couple of days. And so you can see a little bit of soreness or around the area. Some horses can develop what we call hives, or sort of they'll have a little bit of inflammation under their skin, sometimes in the area of the vaccine. But by far and away, most horses that are vaccinated, if they do react at all, they're mild and self-limiting, and only a few even require any treatment with what we call non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, so essentially horsey ibuprofen.
Yes. Okay, super. All right. Well, Dr. Dono, this is a great place for us to take our first break. I want to remind listeners that this is Animal Airwaves Live on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. My guest is Dr. Sally Donato from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about myths of equine health. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. I'm Dana Hill. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. My guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Sally Donato, and we're talking about busting myths of equine health. And when we left off, we'd been talking a lot about sort of vaccinations that horses might get as part of kind of regular checkups from a veterinarian that will keep them safe and ideally free of disease. And Dr. Nana, one of the things that you mentioned as part of kind of general well visits with a veterinarian, teeth. Right? Taking care of a horse's teeth, dental care. Horses, probably like us and even our cats and dogs, would benefit, I'm guessing, from the attention of a health professional and looking at in their mouths.
Yes, they do. Horses have really unique teeth. They are called hypsodont, which means that their cheek teeth or their molars, so the teeth along the sides of their jaws, grow continuously throughout their life. So unlike you or I, who have a set of deciduous or baby teeth, those fall out. They're replaced by our permanent teeth. Horses also have deciduous baby teeth. They get replaced by their permanent adult teeth from the ages of around 2 to 4 years old, depending on the tooth. And then they continue to grow or erupt out of the gum line throughout the horse's entire life until very later on in life, if the horse lives long enough, and horses are living longer and longer every year, they will actually run out of what we call crown. So they actually run out of the reserve of tooth underneath the gum line, and then those teeth fall out and are not replaced. And so the implications of this for horse owners is if you have an animal that has teeth that are continuously growing all the time, slowly, but continuously growing, then they have the ability to grow or wear abnormally such that they can develop sharp points in areas that aren't wearing appropriately. And one of the reasons this happens is the way that we treat, the way that we feed horses today. Some horses eat out of mangers or out of feed bunks that are high off the ground. And so the teeth, as they grind that food between the teeth, where they would normally wear in alignment that is more congruent with a horse that is eating down on the ground, which is what you think about in a wild horse scenario out on the range. They're eating small amounts of gritty, gritty grass, and they're foraging and traveling lots of miles per day, eating small amounts as they go. That's the sort of the natural model for the equine dentition. And if you go and look at a horse that has been naturally grazing in sort of sparse grazing land, they often have mouths that look quite healthy, so, and have never seen a dentist in their whole life, but they have a very natural head carriage. They're eating on the ground and they're eating small amounts of food that appropriately wear down their teeth. The modern horse, if they're anything like my overweight spoiled gelding, he doesn't have to travel or forage or look for food. He just stands in his stall and bangs on the stall door until he gets another meal. And so our modern day commercial diets are tend to be very palatable. They're easy to digest. They're also very easy to chew. And they are often eaten out of buckets or mangers, which lifts the head up and changes the alignment of the horse's teeth. And so as a result, horses in captivity, I don't know if that's the right word, or horses in sort of modern day barn scenarios often have developed points and sharp areas in their mouths over the course of sometimes months to years. And so having a veterinarian or a veterinarian that does dentistry take a look and sometimes wear those points down, and even the horse's dental arcade back into a normal pattern, can minimize that horse's propensity to develop pain while chewing and help prevent them from developing problems masticating and eating their food.
Yeah. Now, when I think about somebody going into my mouth with a file and kind of like grinding on my teeth a little bit, that doesn't sound very appealing. Do horses tolerate this?
Well, we always offer them a lollipop when we're done.
So oh, good.
They often need to be sedated. And so we use chemical sedation fairly frequently, the same kind of sedation that you might use for any other kind of veterinary procedure, which makes them just a little calmer, a little more tractable. And that way you can open their mouth and put in what's called a speculum, which helps helps keep the mouth open, helps prevent them from chewing on your dental equipment or your hands or anything else that you might want to have lived to see another day. And then you can get a really good look at their mouth. You can clean their teeth off, rinse their mouth out, get a good light in there, and really investigate each tooth and decide, do they have teeth that need to be worked on? Do they have teeth even maybe that need to be pulled? Horses are living longer and longer thanks to commercial diets, good deworming, and all the great husbandry advancements that we've made in recent decades. And so it's not uncommon now for horses to live to be 30 or more years old. And so as you can imagine, if we have an older population of horses out there, they develop more sort of what we call old horse dental disease.
Horses that have experienced some of the tooth problems that you described earlier, especially if they kind of run out of teeth, so to speak, as the teeth kind of grow and then stop growing. Let's say they lose some teeth. How do they react to that? Are they able to continue to eat, or do they begin to experience some nutritional deficits?
They do need more frequent dental exams. Those would be the horses that I would recommend have their mouths examined every 6 months to 12 months. Because if you're missing one tooth, then the tooth, if you can imagine, the tooth that is growing above or below it, the opposite tooth, won't have anything to wear against when the horse chews. And so that tooth will become too long, and that will often need to be worn down.
Ah, okay. So really, the kind of, like with people, getting your horse's teeth looked at on a regular basis probably helps you avoid more problems in the long run.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what about horses' hooves? Because one of the misconceptions that I think I grew up with was the idea that a horse's hoof, the part that it's walking on, is sort of the equivalent of our feet or our cat's paws or so forth. But that's not mm-hmm. really the case in terms of like the bone structure of the horse's feet. And I'll ask you to just sort of describe really what the hoof is and then maybe describe some of the care that's required to make sure that the horse can continue to walk comfortably.
Sure. Well, horses are essentially walking on one big giant middle finger in each limb. And so instead of having all of the phalanges or fingers like us or toes, they have developed such that they have one single weight-bearing structure, series of bones that leads down into the hoof. And the hoof itself is a hard connective tissue structure. It does not have the sort of the outside that you see does not have sensation in itself, but on the inside there are what we call the sensitive lamina structures that hold it onto the underlying soft tissues and bones. And that is a highly vascular, meaning it can bleed, have blood flow, and then also innervated, so it has sensation and can feel pain on the inside of that hoof. And so essentially, if you think about it like a fingernail, it's made out of keratin, just like a fingernail. And so there's a certain amount of your fingernail that you can file or trim without any problems, without bleeding or without feeling any pain. But if you were to get up into that sensitive area where it's actually attached to your underlying nail bed, then that can be quite painful, as everybody has experienced when you accidentally rip a nail. And so horses are the same, and they often need regular what we call trimming to keep their foot in kind of a nice, rounded, balanced wear pattern. Again, since horses are not walking 20 miles a day like they might be on the open range. If they were wild, they're often standing in nice cushy bedded stalls in the evening or walking around in beautiful grass fields grazing during the day. So they don't have a lot of natural wear happening to their feet. And so that's where humans step in and help their feet from becoming overgrown. A foot that never gets trimmed in a horse is often, they can actually overgrow to the point where they can curl up and crack or break, causing the horse to actually have some pretty significant lameness and pain, and can even change the bony structure of the foot itself. And that, so some of those can be permanent effects. So hoof care is really, really important in horses.
What role does a horseshoe play in keeping the horse comfortable?
Right. So for horses that are doing either doing a lot of work, so say a horse that's being ridden or is traveling several miles a day under saddle or racing, that horse may, or say a jumping horse that has a lot of concussive forces to their feet as they're coming up and over a jump, those horses can wear their feet excessively. So the opposite of, again, I'll use my fat retired gelding as the example. He doesn't have a lot of wear on his feet these days, but back in the days when he was working regularly, those horses may actually excessively wear their hoof. And so the shoe, which is a metal rim that's attached to the non-sensitive part of the hoof, either with glue or nails, actually protects the bottom of the foot from concussive forces, from bruising, and from excessive wear. And so not all horses need shoes, but they can be really helpful and essential in horses that are working a lot or traveling on particularly types of ground.
Okay, so a lot of good information so far. I think it's time for us to take another break. And when we come back, we've still got a lot more myths to bust here on Animal Airwaves Live. My name is Dana Hill, and my guest today from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Dr. Sally Donato. We're talking about busting the myths of equine health. We'll be back right after this. Hi, welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. So glad to have you along here on this episode. And this Friday, I'm talking to Dr. Sally Donato from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about myths of equine health. And this is a great episode for someone like me who has limited experience with horses, and I'm learning a lot. Some of the questions that I have might seem so obvious to people who deal with horses and care for horses every day. But those of us who don't, well, it's easy to maybe be misinformed about some things. So, Dr. Donato, thank you again for being here with me. I want to talk a little bit about horses and just sort of their life in a stall or in a barn or wherever they might live. How much sleep do horses need? How much sleep do horses need to really be healthy?
I thought you said leave. I was like, vacation leave?
Yeah. How much vacation time do horses need every year?
My horse's life is a vacation.
Yeah,
as far
right.
As I'm concerned, so he doesn't need any.
Yeah.
Sleep. So horses sleep throughout the day and the night, and this is a really common myth that horses only sleep standing up, and that's actually not true. Horses do lie down, and they need to lie down in order to get that deep REM sleep that they do absolutely require. They don't need very much of it, like less than perhaps even an hour, because they can snooze and nap during the day while they stand. Their limbs have what they call a stay apparatus, so their tendons and their bones are structured such that horses can stand and essentially fall into a light sleep and not fall down like you and I would if we tried to sleep standing up. And so they can fulfill much of their sleep requirements while standing, but in order to get that true deep REM sleep that they need, they do need to lie down. And horses that cannot lie down due to the orthopedic pain, so if they have a painful limb or painful back or any variety of reasons that may cause them to not be able to lay down to get that REM sleep, they can actually develop clinical signs of sleep deprivation.
Ah, I see. But do horses generally sleep at night?
Most of them, yep.
Yeah. When horses are not in sort of doing work all the time, like many horses who just kind of have a pretty leisurely life, as you were describing, they're able probably to sleep pretty long hours, right? And when it's dark, not probably too many people are riding horses, so then they go back in their stalls and have the opportunity to sleep. If they don't really need as much of the deep sleep, are they really just getting light sleep the rest of the time?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of barn owners have cameras on their horses or in their barns just to keep track of them. And it's really common for me to hear barn owners say that when they review video from the middle of the night, that the horses will stand in their stalls, they'll snack on and off throughout the night, and then most horses follow a pretty regular pattern where they may sleep for certain hours, so from the hours of midnight to 1 a.m., they might lie down and flat out sleep. Some horses even snore. They can have rapid eye movements, just like humans or dogs when they're sleeping. Some horses can paddle in their sleep if they're probably associated with dreaming. So they sleep just like the rest of us. But then they may get up after only an hour or so and then have a snack and then maybe snooze standing up the rest of the evening.
I want to ask you another question about horses sort of being in barns. Are there any other kind of, you know, health risks associated with being in barns or with doing actually maybe any of the kind of activity that horses might do? For instance, colic is a disease or an affliction that we've talked about on this program before, though it's been a long time, and it's something that would be very vexing to the horse and to anybody who cares for the horse. But for those who aren't really very familiar with it, what are the causes of colic, and are there anything that horse owners can do to sort of reduce the incidence of colic in horses?
Right. Okay. Well, I'll start with the beginning of that as far as horses being in barns or turned out. I always, I think my preference is always to have horses have some access to what we call turnout. So either a pasture, whether it has grass or dirt or some area that they can have some free access to be able to move around. That's probably best for their health long term and their mental well-being. Horses can develop bad habits if they're housed in a stall or confined all the time and perhaps don't get enough exercise. Similar to us, we go a little stir crazy. I know a lot of people felt stir crazy this spring stuck in our homes. And so think about a horse stuck in his stall or a dog in a crate. If they don't get enough interaction and exercise, those types of confinement can lead to behavioral problems. With that said, there are lots of horses that primarily live indoors and can do quite well, particularly horses that are perhaps traveling and have a high exercise load from showing or racing or competing. As far as colic, that's a big topic. Colic just means bellyache, and similar to you or I, a bellyache can be anything from something very minor, so perhaps something you ate, to say appendicitis that would need surgery. Same thing. So big spectrum of very minor and self-limiting to a medical emergency that might even need abdominal surgery. And so probably the best thing to keep horses from colicking from a stabling or environment standpoint is just to not make any big changes rapidly or suddenly. So horses are creatures of habit. They like to have a schedule. Their feeding schedule. We like their diet to stay essentially the same. So if you're going to change the horse's diet to a new hay or a new grain, doing that gradually over a couple weeks at least is really the safest way to do that. If you suddenly introduce the horse to a totally new diet overnight that they're not used to, then they can get quite a bellyache from that.
If a horse should acquire colic, is there anything that horse owners can do to kind of help the horse feel better?
Yeah. So what we often say is the first thing you'll want to do if you think your horse is colicking, and the signs of a horse that's colicking are reflecting just abdominal discomfort. So sometimes the horse might look around and actually look at its side. We call that flank watching. So they might look, turn around as if to say, I don't know why my belly hurts, but I'm going to look at it. They can paw. So they can take their feet and paw at the ground. Some horses, if they're severely painful, can actually roll. So drop on the ground and actually roll up on their back and back and forth. Sometimes horses will sweat and even shake. Their muscles can shake if they're really quite painful. So it can be subtle all the way to a pretty dramatic picture. And the first thing to do is to call the veterinarian. Even if it's a mild case of colic that may resolve on its own without ever needing any medical attention, if your vet is like most vets in the field and they're driving around, covering a lot of ground each day, going from barn to barn, knowing that your horse is colicking, perhaps in a certain part of the county, and might need their attention as an emergency can help get you on their radar, and they can plan their day accordingly, knowing that they may actually need to come out and see your horse as an emergency. The veterinarian can let the horse owner know perhaps some things that they might try to resolve the colic. Some of those things might be just taking the horse for a walk. So if the horse just has a little bit of indigestion, maybe they're a little gassy, taking them for a walk can be quite helpful, or administering there are certain medications that owners may or may not have, may or may not be comfortable giving, and your veterinarian may have you administer a dose of that as pain relief.
I want to ask some questions just about sort of general life of horses. Like a lot of animals that we typically think of as being kind of outdoor sort of animals, cattle, for instance, livestock. Horses might be caught in bad weather, right? Rain, which probably doesn't vex them too much, right? If it's just a light rain. But I wonder about the safety of horses outside, particularly in the kind of thunderstorms that we can have and maybe high wind conditions. What are the recommendations for horses in Florida weather?
In hurricane season, right. Yes, this is another good myth that we hear sometimes. Horse owners will say, well, my horse, if I'm the safest place for me during a hurricane is in the center of my house. And so the safest place for my horse is going to be tucked into the barn. And certainly it feels safer to be sheltered from the wind and the rain. And most barns are strong enough to withstand normal rainstorms, some wind perhaps. But when you think about the force of an actual tropical storm or an actual hurricane that we certainly, of course, have here in Florida, most barns are really not built to withstand that kind of natural force. And so the last thing you want is your horse in a barn, trapped in a stall, as the barn perhaps collapses in on them. Of course, that's going to be extremely dangerous, if not fatal, for all the animals in that barn. And so what we usually recommend is if a hurricane is in preparation for a hurricane to come through, to take a look at the surrounding property that you have available and try to find an area that is high, so not an area that will be prone to flooding, ideally. And that can be just a pasture with a nice hill. So somewhere the horses can get to get out of the water if the water levels do rise, ideally away from power lines that might come down, trees that might come down. Of course, that's, you might not have the luxury of that on all properties, but the safest place for horses during the hurricane is in a true hurricane is actually not in the barn, but rather in a nice open field away from falling objects. And then you have people remove things around their barns like buckets or jumps or things that could be become projectiles in high winds. And then identifying the horses is probably the most important thing to do, making sure that if they were to get loose in a hurricane, if fences were to come down, which they often do, even strong fences can get flattened by falling trees in a hurricane. And so here at the University of Florida, we have a herd of teaching horses here at the university. And when hurricanes are coming, we actually tag them with they have halters on when they're out, and we use kind of like a luggage tag, or it's a livestock tag, but it's a luggage tag essentially with their name and our contact information on their halters. And then we actually spray paint the university phone number on the side of the horse, which sounds a little bizarre, but think of a hurricane coming through and there's horses loose in areas, which happens, having their phone number actually spray painted on them, and it wears off after a couple of days, I promise, is the safest way to get that horse back.
Yeah, wow. I never thought about that, but it does occur to me that if you remember the 1939 film Wizard of Oz, there's the scene where the tornado is coming, and you hear Uncle Henry shout to all the farmhands, get those horses loose. So I guess that makes more sense to me right now. Finally, before we go today, it would be probably wise for us to just a little bit discuss the COVID pandemic. Does this affect horses in any meaningful way?
Right. Luckily, the answer to that is no. We know that the SARS-2 coronavirus that causes COVID-19 in people, it can infect dogs and cats. And there have been a few, it's rare, luckily, but there have been a few cases confirmed, mostly in animals that are in households with someone that is positive for COVID-19. And then many people have heard about the zoo tigers up in New York that actually developed clinical signs of COVID-19. Luckily, we don't think horses are susceptible, or at least there have been no reported cases of horses contracting that specific virus. Horses do have their own coronavirus, which is in the corona family, but it does not infect the one that infects horses, does not infect humans, and the one that infects humans, we don't think infects horses, or at least doesn't cause clinical disease. So that's one good thing about equine coronavirus. The signs of coronavirus are in horses are primarily GI related. Horses get fevers, they stop eating, they can have loose manure or diarrhea sometimes, and they can range from very mild or even asymptomatic infections where the horse might be shedding virus, might be infected, but showing no clinical signs at all the way to horses that might need to end up in the hospital. We do have equine coronavirus here in Florida. It is more common in the wintertime, and we do occasionally see cases of that virus here at the University of Florida. The survival is quite good, even in the horses that need supportive care and hospitalization, and we are able to diagnose that using our a test called the PCR, which identifies the virus actually in horses' manure, and we're able to identify it, diagnose it, and treat it.
Well, Dr. Sally Donato from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dana.
I want to say thank you so much to Sarah Carey and her folks there at the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Dana Hill. You've been listening to Animal Airwaves Live on WUFTFM. My guest today was Dr. Sally Donato from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. I hope you'll be able to join me next week for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.